And hello, everybody. Good late morning, isn't it? Where most of you are, but I know we have people from everywhere. So good, whatever time it is for all of you. And thank you for joining us on this second entry, our second foray into the bread and butter of Exodus and into what liberty means, how this amazingly dense, convoluted story achieves so much more than just the liberation of one people, how it sets in place our understanding of what liberty even means. So thank you for joining us, and let's delve right in. We ended our last class on a very exciting note. We ended it on the scene of Moshe's birth and then his adoption by the Egyptian princess, who, walking by the Nile, hears his cry, moved by compassion, picks him up, adopts him, reunites him with his birth mother as a nursemaid with the facilitation of Miriam, his sister, and raises him as a prince of Egypt. Now, even though it took us an entire class to get to that point, the truth is that it's halfway through the second chapter of the story. It's very early on in the story. In many ways, we could say that it's the opening gambit. Before that was a little bit of exposition about what's the situation in Egypt, what the Jews are doing in Egypt, etc., why they're in this state of subjugation. And then we have the birth of the hero, a very classic opening shot in a story. Now, the thing is that the way stories work is by engaging certain expectations and then using these expectations to pull us through the story and make us pay attention at the right places, make us experience certain things, make us experience satisfaction when the expectations are met, or dismay when the, or shock or pleasant surprise when the expectation is not met, but or rather subverted in some interesting way. So when we look at this opening shot of Exodus, when we look at the birth and adoption of Moshe, we should ask ourselves, when, if you want to understand what the story is all about, what expectations does this moment engender? What kind of hints does it give us to what is to come? And the thing is that if we read Exodus immediately hot upon the heels of Genesis, if we start the Bible with Genesis and just goes on, then we're merely chapters away from the story of a different Jewish boy who ends up rising into prominence, finding his way into the court of an Egyptian king, namely Joseph. In Joseph's case too, a series of events that was horrific, his sale into slavery, but turned out in retrospect to be providential, ends up placing him within Paro's sphere. And then Joseph turns around and uses this power to help his people. So if we had knew nothing about where the story goes for now, if we, let's imagine, let's pretend that all we know is Genesis and chapters 1.5 of Exodus, we may be forgiven for assuming that what's going to follow is a variation on the same story. Here is a baby who, through a series of horrific, yet it turns out providential events, finds himself in the court of an Egyptian king. We are rather justified in expecting him to then turn around and use whatever power he accrues through that set of events to lower the burden from his brethren or even take them out of Egypt wholesale. In fact, this pattern is so ingrained that later in quite a few biblical books or in Hebrew calendar in a few weeks, we will read another story of a Jewish young person who finds himself through a horrific set of events in the court of a powerful king and then uses her power, in this case, since we're talking about Esther and Ahasuerus' court, to save her people. Yet, all this weight of expectation aside, or despite all this weight of expectation, this is not what happens. Instead of growing up in the court and then using his position in the court to help the Jewish people, Moshe's very first actions as an adult, the moments where we see him actually shaping the world and not merely being there as an object of a group of women engaged in giving him life, basically lead him away from his position in court, away from Egypt. And it almost seems, for the span of two chapters, away from the broad story of the Jewish people altogether. Let's look at it together in the source sheet. I believe you have it, but I will share it regardless. I'm here at box number one in the very beginning of that story. Sometime after that, after Moshe's adoption and naming, when Moses has grown up, he went out to his kinsfolks and witnessed their labors. I just want to emphasize that in Hebrew it doesn't say witness, it says saw. He looked at their labors, and I'll come back to why it's important in a bit. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his kinsmen. He turned this way and that, and seeing no one about, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. So we already, at this stage, see that Moshe doesn't see himself as holy Egyptian or holy of the king's men. There's a certain sense of kinship implied here between him and the Hebrews. Now, admittedly, we're never told if Moshe feels the sense of kinship, but it's very strongly implied in the text that he cares about the fate of the Hebrew men. But it doesn't end here. When he went out the next day, he found two Hebrews fighting. So he said to the offender, "Why do you strike your fellow?" He retorted, "Who made you chief and ruler over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Moses was frightened and thought, "Then the matter is known." As long as the matter is not known, Moshe can still remain in the Egyptian court and still fulfill our expectations of using his power as a prince for the good. But once it's known, matters take a different turn because Paro learns about it. I'm here at verse 15. When Paro learned of the matter, he sought to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Paro. At this point, he's leaving Egypt and leaving his position of power. He arrived in the land of Midian and sat down beside a well. Now, the events that will follow are events that are going to cement him in his place in the land of Midian by giving him a new family and a new occupation and a new way of life. And here it is. Now, the priest of Midian had seven daughters. They came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Now, I want to pause for a second and say the following. If I mentioned before that the way storytelling works is by awakening certain expectations in us and then using them to pull us through. In this case, after the book of Genesis, we already have a certain established pattern in our mind. We already know that a lot of times betrothals stem from something that happens by a well. We already saw that happening in Isaac's case. We already saw it happening in Jacob's case. So even hearing just that Moses is sitting by the well and that there's girls by the same well, rings a little bell. This time the story does follow up on the expectation instead of frustrating it, because indeed a betrothal is about to happen. I'm here at verse 17. But shepherds came and drove them off. Moses rose to their defense and he watered their flock. When they returned to their father Reuel, he said, "How is it you have come back so soon today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "Where is he then? Why did you leave the man? Ask him to break bread." Moses consented to stay with the men, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah as wife. She bore a son whom he named Gershom, for he said, "I have been a stranger in a foreign land." Here he is, building a new family, creating a relationship with a father-in-law, with a wife, with sisters-in-law, all six, giving birth. At this point, Moshe looks as far from the Jewish story as can be. It seems as if the grand narrative that started in the beginning of Exodus with the names of those who came to Egypt and then their descendants who grow and then become subjugated, it's just behind. It's just the past. The past is prologue. What's happening now, the focus of the story, is Moses' life in Midian. But if we take a step back and we look again at the very passages we just read and look at them not merely as a story that details how one man goes from place to place, but rather as little hints, little foreshadowings of what's to come, we will see that the very story that details to us how Moses ended up going out of Egypt, of the cord, of the narrative of the Jewish people, foreshadow all the ways in which he's going to then serve, advance, shape the Jewish story upon his return to Egypt. I'm opening it again. Sorry, just a second. The first that Moshe does. Moshe, can you hear me? Yeah. Moshe, the first thing that Moshe does once he grows up is he went out to his kinfolk and witnessed their labors. He goes and sees things. Now, it may sound random. It may sound as a non-important fact, but the truth is that seeing things, pausing to notice things, will now become a staple of Moshe's life, one of the tools that enable him to carry out his job as liberator under God. Because the story of his rise as a liberator will start at a moment when he notices something. Let us see that moment. In box 2 in Exodus 3, verses 1 to 4. Now Moses, tending the flock of his father-in-law Yitro, the priest of Midian, drove the flock into the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. A messenger of Hashem appeared to him, or an angel in the more traditional translation, in a blazing fire out of a bush. He gazed, in Hebrew, vayal, the same verb as we saw him use when he went to see his brothers, and there was a bush all aflame, yet the bush was not consumed. Now, we might think that this is the moment when God is going to reveal himself and start speaking to Moses. After all, we already know that this is a moment of revelation. We were informed by that by verse 2. But before God can reveal himself, Moshe responds to his own sight. Moshe said, I must turn aside to look, lir'ot va'er'eh, again, the same verb, at this marvelous sight. Why doesn't the bush burn up? Only then, when we see how seriously Moshe takes the act of seeing, does God reveal himself. When God saw that he had turned aside to look, God called to him out of the bush, Moshe, Moshe. And he answered, here I am. I wonder in our own life how many times we see burning bushes and don't pause to take a look at them. Don't notice the incongruity. Don't notice that something wondrous or larger than life is happening. And just keep going and miss the revelation that's hidden in them. What's special about Moshe is that he sees. And when he sees, he acts. Later, he is going to become the man who sees God face to face. And God repeatedly describes him as the prophet who saw God most clearly. Nobody ever will come as close. Eventually, he's going to be the man who sees the promised land without crossing the Jordan River. I'm here at the next source. It's from Deuteronomy 34. Moses went up from the steppes of Moab to Mount Nebo, to the summit of Pisgah, opposite Jericho. And God showed him the whole land, Gilad, as far as Dan, etc. And God said to him, this is the land of which I swore to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. I will assign it to your offspring. I have let you see it. Eticha, the same verb, see with your own eyes, but you shall not cross there. His whole life characterizes Moses as a man who first and foremost sees. But seeing is not enough. People can see and yet not act upon it. The thing that's unique about Moshe and the thing that foreshadows his particular roles is that when he sees wrongs, he stops to correct them. Much like his adoptive mother, the daughter of Paro, who heard a baby cry, saw the baby, and felt moved by compassion not to let this baby simply die. When Moshe sees the Egyptian beating a Hebrew, he turned this way and that, and seeing no one about, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. This first action, besides sight itself, foreshadows for us the main project that Moses is going to have to carry out in the very following chapters, namely the project of removing the Egyptians' oppressors' power over the Hebrews. Before he can carry out any other mission, this is going to be his mission. In other words, what he did on a personal one-on-one level when he intervened in the scene of oppression of an Egyptian beating a Jew, a Hebrew, he's going to now do on the national scale. This is what God informs him after showing him that burning bush. God says, and I'm jumping down to box 3, and God said, and we're here at the burning bush after Moshe says, here I am, remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you stand is holy ground. And continued, I am the God of your father's house, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. And God continued, I have marked well the plight of my people in Egypt and have heeded their outcry because of their taskmasters. Yes, I am mindful of their sufferings. Much like Moshe himself, by the way. When Moshe goes and sees the suffering and intervenes, God says, I will too. I have come down to rescue them from the Egyptians and to bring them out of the land to a good and spacious land, etc., etc. I'm jumping to verse 10. Come, therefore, I will send you to Pharaoh, and you shall free my people, the Israelites, from Egypt. Just as it was his first action personally, saving a Jew, a Hebrew from an Egyptian, now he has to go and carry forth the same mission on the national level. But the foreshadowing, the way that these events in Moshe's life, the details of his leaving the story for a while, don't only encapsulate and foreshadow his first mission, namely removing the Egyptian oppressors off or taking them off the suffering Hebrews, it also foreshadows what will then become during the Exodus itself and then during the many and long and difficult years in the desert, his other great task, the task of dealing with the squabbling Jews. On the second day of Moses going out to see his brothers, and I'm repeating again in box 1, verse 13, when he went out the next day, he found two Hebrews fighting. So he said to the offender, why do you strike your fellow? He returned, who made you chief and ruler over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Moses was frightened, etc., etc. Now, it's almost funny how much this little exchange between Moses and the Hebrew, for all we know, the first exchange Moses ever has with any of his brethren, how much it will continue echoing over and over and over and over again in Moses' life. I'm just going to bring a few short examples, but like I could write a whole book just with these examples. There's so many of them. Very early on, when Moses starts carrying out his mission and talks to Pharaoh for the first time, and Pharaoh responds by laying new restrictions over the Israelites in retaliation, a delegation of the Hebrews come out to talk to Moses and basically tell him off. I'm here at box 4, Exodus chapter 5. As they left Pharaoh's presence, they came upon Moses and Aaron standing in their path. We're talking here about the leaders of the Jews who were just told by Pharaoh about their new burdens. And they said to them, may God look upon you and punish you for making us loathsome to Pharaoh and his courtiers, putting a sword in their hands to slay us. Even after Moses is going to bring his promises into fruition and save these people and take them out of Egypt, they're going to complain and squabble over and over again. Way later in the desert, for example, when Korach, a Levite, will stand to Moses and say, wait a minute, how come you have all the power? You and your brother have all the power and we don't. Datan and Aviram support him. Two men support him. And when Moses tries to speak to them, they say the following audacious and offensive speech. I'm here in number 16, and I'm going to jump straight to verse 13. Is it not enough that you brought us from a land flowing with milk and honey to have us die in the wilderness, that you would also lord it over us? Even if you had brought us to a land of flowing with milk and honey and given us possessions of fields and vineyards, should you gouge out the eyes of those involved, we will not come. Interestingly, the Midrash, the sages here, and Rashi in his commentary on the Torah, quotes them, decide to turn these two men, the Tan and Aviram, that speak to Moses with these brazen terms, into kind of like these repetitive villains of the piece. And later they even tell us that those were the same people who Moses saw fighting and tried to tell off on his second day of going out to see his brethren. But even without this very direct commentary, this direct connection between those instances that the commentary imposes on the text, it's clear that when Moses meets those squabbling Hebrews, he is in a sense taking the first step unknowingly. At this point, he doesn't know it yet, and he's going to spend years and years in Midian first. But unknowingly, he's taking the first step in what's going to become one of the most cumbersome and difficult projects of his life. Excuse me. Now, we might well think that once Moses is already out of Egypt and sitting by that well in Midian, the foreshadowing ends. Because while things in Egypt might have relevance for the big story, when he's in Midian, he's just building a family. What has that to do with anything? But even there, the events continue to hint to us as to what Moshe's work is going to be in the future. Because the next step in what Moses does is to give water. He helps the daughters of Yitro have access to water. After getting us out of Egypt, and in between dealing with squabbling Hebrews and their various complaints, one of Moses's ongoing tasks is going to be getting us water in the desert. Time and time again, from very early on, 3 days after the parting of the sea, which we will discuss in class 5 at length, but 3 days after they saw the hand of God literally tearing open an ocean for them, the Israelites are going to crowd on Moses, crying out that they have no water. And this is going to become a repetitive pattern. Time and time again, in the desert, so they have some justification, the people lose faith and beg for water, and it falls to Moses to either hit or talk to rocks. This is a long and separate story for another time, to give them this water or to lead them to a place of water guided by God. But, and here it goes even deeper, the sages say that when the Torah, when the text here, the biblical text talks about water, what it really alludes to is something else. What it really alludes to is the Torah itself. I'll show it in the source sheet. I'm reading here in box 5, and I'm reading from the Talmud, from the Bavli, in Kama Bava Kama. As it is taught, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. This is about the situation I just described that took place immediately after the opening of the sea. Those who interpret verses said that water here is referring to nothing other than Torah, the Jewish law. As it is stated, ho, everyone who thirsts, come for water. This is from Isaiah. The verse means that since the Jews traveled for 3 days without hearing any Torah, they became weary. And therefore, the prophets among them arose and instituted for them that they should read from the Torah each Shabbat and pause on Sunday and read again on Monday and pause on Tuesday and Wednesday and read again on Thursday and pause on Shabbat Eve so they would not tarry 3 days without hearing the Torah. And the implication here is ever again. Let's pause for a second because it's worthy of, this commentary is worthy of unpacking. You could say, oh, okay, whatever, it's just symbolic language. It just, you know, instead of just sticking with the simple fact, which is people in the desert need water, and saying it makes sense that if for 3 days they had no water, they started complaining about it. The sages seem to just say, oh, no, let's talk about Torah instead. And you might feel that it just imposed upon it, that this is an oddly invasive, heavy-handed commentary. But let's think about the psychology of it. Let's think about these people who just left Egypt and then saw this enormous miracle, impossible miracle, and saw their erstwhile oppressors drown. And again, we will talk about that in a few weeks at length. And now they're going on. They must be very, how to put it, overwhelmed. They must be wondering, what are we supposed to do with ourselves? Okay, so the Egyptians are dead And God does miracles for us. But what are we supposed to do next? Who are we now? We're no longer slaves. And we're no longer in the throes of the crisis, running away, crossing the sea, celebrating. Nothing instinctive is there to guide us anymore. And our past can't be used as our blueprint because we're no longer in that past. What do we do next? And I think it is this unease, this feeling of not knowing what's up and down and left and right and where they're supposed to go and what they're supposed to do, that the sages catch on to here with their interpretation. Because what does it mean to say they had no Torah? It meant that they had no law, that they had no guidance, that they had no way of knowing what they're supposed to do at every moment, at every day, at every week. And the Torah here becomes necessary not simply because it's an important code of laws. It's important because it gives them an alternative way of life that they can use and rely on and feel comfortable within. And we will see in the desert, the Israelites time and time again fall into a sort of unease that clearly stems from still carrying on with them their slave mentality, the mentality of somebody better tell us what to do or we're just going to stop. We're just going to try and find food and stuff and everything. And that moment, 3 days after the great miracle, is the first instance of that. And Moses, his job is not just to supply their sustenance, their need for water. He has to supply their need for guidance, their need for knowing what to do next, for the life force that comes from knowing what's your place in the world. So it's highly symbolic that what he does after he saves one Hebrew from an Egyptian and then tries to broker peace between two squabbling Hebrews is to supply people with water, because later on he's going to be supplying people with water and also with that which water stands for as a symbol in the sage's mind, Torah itself, which of course he will be the one to give us at Mount Sinai, and we'll discuss that in a few weeks as well. And I have to say that while we cover now the details of Moshe's going out of the story in Egypt, right? Killing the Egyptian, dealing with the squabbling Hebrews, giving water to the girls in Midian, the going out itself is extremely important. The very fact that Moses, perhaps upsetting our expectation that he will use his position in court to help us, leaves instead, is both necessary and rich and portentous meaning of itself. What do I mean by that? Why is it necessary? It's necessary because in the Exodus, and we will see that very clearly next week already, God is not trying to merely move us from one geographic location to another. God is trying to establish a totally new world order. And it's hard to believe that we could have done that with Paro's permission and by his grace. If Moshe was our savior by virtue of having Paro's ear, we would have simply been another development in Egyptian history, another chapter in the long world history written by emperors and tyrants and slaveholders. By first taking Moshe out, God ensures that Moshe then comes in as his, I'm capitalizing the H here, emissary, the emissary of something new and different and other, the emissary of the future rather than the past. But it's more than necessity. The leaving here foreshadows something also. And it foreshadows something that we won't really discuss in this course because it has to do with the very end of Moses' life, but we'll touch upon it now briefly. If we ever do a course on Deuteronomy, we'll talk about it at length then. Because at the eve of Moshe's life, after he already watched a generation of slaves march out and die in the desert, and their children grow up and become ready to cross the Jordan River and seize their fate and destiny and build a Jewish society in the promised land, he knows that he's about to die. He knows that the best he's going to get is to see the promised land, not to be in the promised land. And he has to make sure somehow that these people who are about to embark on the adventure of their life will remain faithful to that world order that God is trying to lead them to create. He needs to make sure that they don't forget, that they don't, once they settle down and grow happy and fat, as he says to them at one point, and prosperous and rich, they might, with prosperity as a poison in their veins, forget about God, forget about how they used to be slaves in Egypt, forget about everything they were supposed to learn from it, and just become another society, another chapter in that long history of the world. And Moses knows that if that happens, they're going to fall apart. God is going to exile them. The land is going to kick them out. But more to the point, they're just going to fall apart. They're not going to carry forth their mission. And he needs to find a way to help them carry this mission. And the way he finds is by giving them a story that they can go on passing on to their children. But the story that they need to pass on to their children can't be, Moses took us out of Egypt. Because if what they tell their children is, hi kids, this is Passover, this is a Seder, let me tell you a story. The story is there is this one great man, Moses, and he took us out of Egypt. Then nothing changed because we no longer have Moses. And it's Moses' story, not our story. So what does it mean to us? How can we, the children sitting around that table in that Seder, in that land of Israel of old, how can we learn anything from it if it's a story about this heroic, almost bigger than life character, Moses? And so when Moses retells the story to this generation in the book of Deuteronomy, which is basically mostly just Moses telling the story, he tells it in a way that withdraws himself from the story in many significant ways and makes it much more the story of the people than his own. Let's see it together here in the source sheet. And again, it's a beautiful, I mean, amazing storytelling feat that carries through the entire book, but we'll just see it in the beginning of Deuteronomy. I'm here at box 6. Our God Hashem, God, spoke to us at Horeb. So already God is speaking not to me and then I tell you, but rather to us. The voice here is the plural, saying, you have stayed long enough at this mountain. Start out and make your way to the hill country of the Amorites, and to all their neighbors in the Arava, the hill country, the Shelah, the Negev, the Seacoast, the land of the Canaanites and the Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. Now, I want to point out that in English, the you is ambiguous, right? You and your could be singular and could be plural. In Hebrew, it's not ambiguous at all. It says pnu, su, bo, all plural verbs. See, I place the land at your disposal. Again, lifnechem, in the plural. Go, take possession of the land that God swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to assign to them and to their heirs after them. Thereupon, I said to you, for the first time, after saying this great mission as directed to the entire people, without him as the go-between, even though we know historically he was, now he says, I. Now he brings himself into the story. But look what he does at that very moment when he himself speaks. Thereupon, I said to you, I cannot bear the burden of you by myself. Your God has multiplied you until you are today as numerous as a star in the sky. May God, the God of your ancestors, increase your number, etc., etc. And then in verse 12, how can I bear unaided the trouble of you and the burden, bickering? Pick from each of your tribes candidates who are wise, discerning, and experienced, and I will appoint them as your heads. You answered me and said, what you propose to do is good. In other words, the first moment when Moshe introduces himself as a singular I to this story is the very moment when he withdraws from singular leadership of the people and invites them to bring forth their own leadership. Now, this is a moment of historical revisionism. Because in Exodus, and we will touch upon it in a few weeks, this is not what happened. What actually happened was that Moses was toiling and toiling, trying to adjudicate cases for all the people and just not getting to all the load and wearing himself out. And his father-in-law, who was visiting at the time, looked at him and said, "This is not a good idea. You need to raise other leaders who will help you with adjudicating the people." And Moses said, "Oh, this is an excellent thought." Now, the commentators try and make these two versions, the version in Exodus and the way Moses retells it here in Deuteronomy, work out and be true at the same time. And I'm not going to go into it right now. This is not what this course is about. I will only say that it makes a lot of sense for Moses to retell it in this way, because what's relevant for these people on the verge of going into Israel, as they need to hold onto a story so that they will remember and pass on their identity to their kids, it's not the whole story of Moses struggling with administration and other people in Moses's family coming in with advice and being proven right. That's not relevant for them. What they need is to hear about how they are part of the story. They, the people in plural, are the ones who are making it happen. So when Moses comes and says, "I gave you this idea and you embraced it," what he's telling them is the story really started when God gave all of us a mission and you as a group rose to the challenge and helped me make it happen. In order to do that, he needs to withdraw his ego, his presence, his initiative, which is very pronounced throughout the story in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. He needs to withdraw all of that to allow the story to stand on its own without him and carry forth the job that he did first. He needs to leave the story with him to do what he did until now, which was keep them connected to their past and to God and to each other. So even the very fact that Moses starts his career by withdrawing from the story of the Jewish people and going somewhere else is in itself a foreshadowing of his last and perhaps greatest gift to us as a historic leader, the withdrawal from the story that he perpetrates, that he initiates and carries out at the end of his life. But while rich with foreshadowings and rich with portentous moments, this story of going out, of going to meet and ending up immersed in Midian, does end. And Moshe is called forth to come back. And the moment when he's called forth is the moment we already read together, the moment of the burning bush and God informing him that he was chosen to go and carry out the liberation of the people and bring them to the first the mountain, the same mountain where he's at, to get the Torah, starting to worship God there, and eventually to the promised land. And at that moment, something very interesting happens. Because if until this moment, Moshe's actions foreshadow his own future projects as the leader of the Jewish people under God, now what it takes for him to go from point A, the burning bush, to point B, back in Egypt and carrying out the mission, foreshadows not his experience in the future, but rather what the people will experience as they undergo liberation, the conditions and experiences that they themselves will undergo. And I want to touch shortly, or briefly, I guess is the right term, upon four of these aspects of the big liberation that Moshe experiences first on his way back to Egypt, becoming, in a sense, almost an avatar or a prefiguring for our national experience later on. The first thing I want to talk about is at the core, or at least one of the cores of Moshe's initial response to God's mission. Because Moshe's initial response when God talks to him from the burning bush is not, "Yay, I will do that," but rather, no, I'm the wrong person for the job. They wouldn't believe me. Paro wouldn't believe me. I wouldn't know how to do that. And after God keeps telling him, "No, you can do it. I'll give you signs to Paro. I'll support you with the people. This is what you should tell them," Moshe reaches another objection, and he says the following. Moment. I am here in box 7. But Moses said to God, "Please, O my Lord, I have never been a man of words." By the way, isn't it ironic that the man who's not a man of words will end up giving us the whole book called Words, Dvarim, because he spoke so much to leave us this story at the end. But here he says, "I have never been a man of words, either in times past or now that you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and slow of tongue." Moshe feels that there's something in his speech that's deficient. And God tells him, "I will help you overcome it." And God said to him, I'm reading here, "Who gives human speech? Who makes them dumb or deaf, seeing or blind? Is it not I, God? Now go, and I will be with you as you speak and will instruct you what to say." In a way, Moshe here represents the state of the Jewish people. Because what we know about this people is that they can't even call out to God eloquently to express their own suffering. Earlier in the book, in the second chapter, we heard the following. A long time after that, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites were groaning under the bondage and cried out. But both groaning and cried out, which in Hebrew is Ye'anchu and Vayezaku, are very explicitly not words that come with content. They make noise. They groan like an animal. They scream in pain. But there's no words there. They don't know yet how to express this distress. And words are so much more than just a means of communication here. Words mean that you can look around you and recognize your situation and give it meaning and frame it in some way. And once you can do that, you can also work towards changing it. And the Jews cannot. The Hasidim, and using a Kabbalistic term, the Hasidim from the 17th century onwards, 1700s onwards, used a Kabbalistic term called Galut HaDibur, the exile of speech. They said that in Egypt, it wasn't merely an exile of the flesh and a subjugation of the flesh. We lost our ability of speech. We didn't have a way of describing things, of talking about things, of making sense of the world. And part of what Moses' job is going to be is to help the Hebrews find their language, find who they are and what they are and express themselves and learn to speak this language. But first he has to do it himself. He has to first encapsulate, first experience and prefigure the salvation from this exile of speech that they will have to undergo as they go out of Egypt. So this is one thing he has to become the avatar for. But here's another thing, and it's a very important thing, and it's there in God's answer when Moses responds to God's assurances that he will help him speak with dismay, saying, "No, I can't do it. I really cannot do it." And then God gets annoyed and says, "Fine, you can't do it. Go anyway, and I'll bring someone else to speak for you." And if this someone else is not going to be just anyone, it's going to be your brother. But he said, "Please, oh my Lord, make someone else your agent." God became angry with Moses and said, "There is your brother Aaron the Levite. He, I know, speaks readily. Even now he is setting out to meet you and he will be happy to see you. You shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth. I will be with you and with him as you speak and tell both of you what to do. And he shall speak for you to the people. Thus he shall serve as your spokesman with you playing the role of God to him." In other words, what God is saying here is that Moshe doesn't need to fear that he's going to have to carry out the redemption all by himself. Because his brother is going to come and together they will become almost one unit. The verses there are very beautiful. You'll be his God. He'll be your mouth. He will speak for you. You will say to him and he will speak to you. Here, let's see it again. It's just a very powerful language of merging. If you look at it here, it says, "You shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth. I will be with you and with him as you speak and tell both of you what to do. And he shall speak for you to the people. Thus he shall serve as your spokesman." Which in Hebrew is not spokesman, it's peh, it's your mouth. It's not only you will put words in his mouth, he will become your mouth. You will become even more merged, as if it's one face with the brain and the mouth and the same words coming out, with you playing the role of God to him. This idea, or this fact that Moses needs Aaron to carry out the mission, is very significant. It's significant philosophically for the story, because our entire story of exile in Egypt started with brothers fighting and hating each other and selling one another. So it's very appropriate that our redemption from Egypt starts when two brothers come and work together. But it's more than that, because they don't only work together. Their joy, their fraternal joy, is honest. The text here makes a point of saying that he will be happy to see you in his heart, which the Midrash, the sages, catch on to and point out. In his heart is to say that it's not just, you know, a smile at you because I have that told me. No, it's genuine. He will feel it. Perhaps this feeling is necessary for two people to become really like one mouth speaking as one. You can't really merge together. You can't work together as one. More than that, this closeness is necessary in political terms, because all the things that make Moses a good tool for God to use, the fact that he's not part of the people, that he's coming from the outside, that he's not an outgrowth of their life in Egypt, but rather can carry a message from outside into Egypt, also means that he will have a hard time communicating with them. He didn't grow up amongst them. He didn't share their experience of subjugation. He spent 40 years living in Midian with his own new family. What does he know about their suffering? How can he speak for them and help them regain their voice? And those things are what makes Aaron a perfect vessel or a perfect partner in this endeavor, because between them, they can bridge and bring insight from outside and understanding from within and make it work together. But it's not just that this cooperation is symbolically pleasing when we think about Joseph and his brother, or politically prudent when we think about Moshe's shortcomings as an outsider. It's also a foreshadowing of the only way that redemption can work in Egypt and always, namely, if we work together. The Israelites are going to have to learn how to work together if they want to carry out their work of liberation beyond getting out of the Egyptian oppressor, out of the yoke of the Egyptian oppressor, and into the actual work of building a life of liberty as a group, as a society. Now, so we said already that the fact that Moshe has to acquire speech and the fact that he has to work with his brothers foreshadow what the people will have to experience to achieve liberation. Another thing that will have to happen for the people is that they will have to get their hands bloody. They will have to get their hands bloody, literally, because before the last plague, they're going to be asked to put blood on the doors. But more deeply than that, they will have to be willing to pay the price of sacrifice and sorrow. Going out of Egypt is not going to be an easy process. There's going to be difficulties. There's going to be hardships. There are going to be wars down the line. You can't build God's society in the promised land without fighting a war first. And even that is foreshadowed in the story of Moses' return, because on his way back to Egypt, we run into this very, very cryptic passage. I'm here at box 9. At a night encampment on the way, God encountered him and sought to kill him. So Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and touched his legs with it, saying, "You are truly a bridegroom of blood to me." And when God let him alone, she added, "A bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision." Now, this is such a cryptic group of verses. Why does God try and kill the man he just sent upon his way? And why did Moses not circumcise his son? And why does it take Zipporah to circumcise her son? Why does she understand what to do here instead of Moses? Sadly, we don't have time to get into any of that. But what we see very clearly is that there's no going into Egypt before there's an act of brit, of covenant, in this case, brit milah, the covenant that we do through circumcision, and that the act of covenant requires bloodying of the hands. So this too gives us a little bit of a sense of what lies ahead. Now, there's one last thing I want to mention. Maybe I'll look at some of the questions first and then stay with me. And a minute to the end of the class, I will mention one last thing that Moses has to experience for himself. Let me look at the questions. Moment. Okay.
Hello?
Why are we referring? Sorry?
I'm sorry. I went back. I did the wrong thing. I don't know. What?
You have a question, Sandy?
Where are you? I don't hear you. Where are you?
Maxine, can you pin me? I'm going to look through the questions in the meantime. Excuse me. Okay. Why are we referred to as my people, as listed in Exodus 3:7? Aren't we Hashem's people only after we make a covenant with him, basically? Why does God speak to us as his people? So you're right that we didn't consent to becoming God's people until the covenant in Sinai in a formal way, but we are the nation that he promised to his chosen patriarchs, through Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And he told Abraham directly, you will have these children and they will end up suffering in bondage and then I will save them. So in that regard, we are God's. We are God's people because he foresaw and planned and made the whole thing come down a certain way. Just a moment. Susanna Levin wrote, Bnei Israel were without structure in the desert for 3 days. I agree. And it's kind of interesting, right? Because there is some structure. Obviously, they walked in a certain direction, but I think psychologically, that's not very satisfying. Someone named iPad, or whose avatar here is named iPad, wrote, Torah there is tied up and in the fabric of culture, how to live big and small. By making the Tanan of Iran the villains in more than one place, are the sages telling us obliquely to root out evil and bad people, etc., early, else they will cause problems again and again. So interestingly, there's a direct, the sages tell a direct story like that. They say that the man who created or made possible to create the golden calf was a baby that Moses saved. They tell this whole story that's not really rooted in the text at all, that says how Moses saw the Egyptians using Hebrew babies for building, using them between bricks. This is a gruesome and terrible image. And he saw these babies and Moshe complained to God and said, how can you let innocent babies die? And God said, well, these are not innocent people. These are people who I see will come to bad end, will do bad things. And Moshe said, excuse me, aren't you the God of justice? Shouldn't you judge people for what they already did? And God says, you know what? Why don't we do an experiment? You want to save this baby? Save this baby. And then this baby causes no end of trouble. So it's not related exactly to the Tanan of Iram, but I think it would indicate that the sages are trying to convey some message about, I don't know about rooting out. They didn't have power to do that at their time. At their time, they lived under foreign rulers. They didn't have that power to root out anybody. But maybe they're expressing some sort of wishful thinking that wouldn't it be nice if we could just, you know, tell that someone is going to be a terrible person and not have to deal with them in adulthood. But I think that and this is its own class. We don't have time to go into it right now, but it's a problematic, difficult, theologically challenging motivation on the sages' part that requires a lot of thought to understand why they're thinking that and where they're coming from. Specifically, in the case of the Tanan of Iram, I want to argue that there's a different direction they're coming from, which is actually to minimize guilt. The sages very consistently look at all these cases where the Israelites complain in Egypt, on the way out of Egypt, in the desert before going to Israel, and they're not comfortable with it. They really want to have scapegoats. They want to concentrate the blame. And they constantly try and say that most of the people who complained were not genuine Israelites, but rather the Erev Rav, those Egyptians who kind of went along with the Jews as they left Egypt, which is its own interesting and problematic interpretation or interpretational policy, right? Because why? Why are you so uncomfortable with saying that the Israelites are the ones complaining? Why do you want to throw it all on either very few Jews, like the Tana and Aviram, who suddenly become, you know, the scapegoats for everything that was ever said out of line, or on people of Egyptian origin? Again, an interesting question to ponder. I can't really go into it right now. I would say, though, that it's telling that the pshat, the text as it is, the simple text, doesn't go that way. The pshat doesn't have any difficulty in telling us the Israelites or the Hebrews squabbled and complained without any attempt to assign it to anybody specific and get it out of the way, except when there's particular actors making particular claims, like later in the case of the Tana and Aviram. A moment. Sima Herzberg pointed out that just as in Deuteronomy, Moses withdraws, he has a very minimal presence in the Haggadah. Exactly. In many ways, Moshe himself models for us how to tell the story of the Haggadah. He obviously didn't write it, but it was compiled many, many years later. But he's the first to tell the story that doesn't have him as the hero. And in that sense, when we read the story in the Haggadah, we may not be hearing the name Moshe as frequently as we would if we were simply reading the book of Exodus, but we are following in the footsteps of Moshe in the way we tell the story itself. Tova Shimon wrote, Moshe is an example of a leader listening to good advice and criticism. I would agree. A moment. And also that Moshe's withdrawal to allow the nation to take the initiative sounds a bit like the Hasidic concept of God withdrawing or constricting, so to speak, to allow the world to function. That's a really, I didn't think about it. That's a beautiful parallel. But God here, in the sense, Moshe, we talked about Moshe as symbolizing his own future, as symbolizing or foreshadowing the people's future. And here he's standing as an avatar to God. Just like God, to allow the world to exist has to remove some of his presence with all its deterministic meaning, so does Moshe has to remove himself a little bit to allow us around to grow. Moment. Gershon Hapner wrote, God is a Deus absconditus, and Moses, by telling the Israelites that he cannot bear their burden alone, tells them that he will become a leader who is absconditus, absents himself. This is his personal imitatio Dei, along the same lines. Yes, very beautifully put. Unfortunately, I have to stop answering questions now because I did promise you another way in which what Moses lives through foreshadows everything that's to come for the people, or gives us a little bit of hints as to what they're going to do in terms of liberation. I'm going to put my personal email in the chat. Excuse me for a moment. So that if you have a question you want to continue discussing with me, you can email me. I can't promise exactly when I'll answer, but I'll try to answer it. Last point as to how Moses' personal experience upon his return to Egypt becomes a prefiguring of what the people will have to pursue in order to achieve leadership, liberty. Sorry, also leadership, but liberty more specifically. What happens to Moses when he comes back is very interesting, because you'd think that he'll come back as a conquering hero. Here I am bringing the word of God. Instead, the hesitant man, the conflicted and hesitant man we saw talk to God at the burning bush, is the man who comes back. And even after talking to Paro and after talking to the Jews one time, he's still conflicted and confused, especially when it seems to backfire on the short term. And when after talking to Paro said, these slaves have too much free time. They're agitating. They're creating problems. Let's give him even more work. And the Israelites come with that very strong rebuke to Moses and Aaron that we read earlier in the class. And then Moses expresses once more his hesitation and sense of, maybe in modern terms we'll call it imposter syndrome, to God. Here's what he says. I'm here in box 10. Then Moses returned to God and said, Oh, my Lord, why did you bring harm upon this people? Why did you send me? Ever since I came to Paro to speak in your name, he has dealt worse with his people. And still you have not delivered your people. All I did was make it worse. Why are you putting me here? Why are you sending me? Why are you causing harm to these people through me? What's interesting is God's response. God's response is not, or perhaps I should say, it's not just the God, it's the storyteller here, the narrator of the story. God doesn't tackle it directly. God doesn't answer, no, it'll be okay, don't worry, you just need to wait. Instead, after Moshe expresses this, and then later in chapter 6, once again says, I'm going to jump here to Exodus 6, verse 12, that Moses appealed to God saying, the Israelites would not listen to me. How then would Paro heed me who gets tongue-tied? God simply goes on by ordering him to go. But then the text veers and suddenly goes into the weeds, into something that looks totally unrelated, into giving us the genealogy of the Israelites. But following are the heads of the respective clans. Didn't we already do that? Why do we need to know that now? Who cares? We're in the middle of Moses being sent to speak to Paro. Why are we pausing for all of this? But then as we read down, we see that the point of the genealogy is to tell us about Moshe's family. Because when we reach verse 20, we hear, Amram took into his household his wife, his father's sister, Yocheved, and she bore him Aaron and Moses, and the span of Amram's life was so-and-so. And then it goes on to talk about Aaron's family. And then it ends by saying, and I'm jumping to verse 26, it is the same Aaron and Moses to whom God said, bring forth the Israelites from the land of Egypt, etc., etc. Why on earth do we need to know all of that? Perhaps the reason we need to know all of that, the reason we need to suddenly ground Moses in his genealogical history, is that in order to have the heart and the courage to carry out the work of liberty, which isn't achieved by one speech or one appeal to power or one conversation with the people, what Moshe needs is to remember who he is, to remember where he's coming from, to remember how he's connected to the human society around him, not only through omission, not only in some abstract way, but physically, viscerally, as a member of a family. Last week, we saw how the first thing that the Israelites lost before their freedom was their names, their sense of identity, perhaps. What Moshe has to regain to have the confidence to move forward, and what the people as a whole will have to regain afterwards, is exactly that. It's knowing who and what they are. And next week, we will see how, next week, we will see how God goes about helping them to reach that point. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you for your patience with getting past the time of the time limit of the class. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing you next week and going on with the story. Maxine, I'm giving the mic to you. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time as well. And I'm looking forward to seeing everyone next week, if not in an hour, with Rev Alex Israel. Or maybe sometime later this week. But anyway, thank you so much and enjoy your time. Thank you.
Have a good day.
Thank you.